Today is Monday, November 25th, 2019. This is a part four, a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with John Weisheit, Weisheit. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, John. How are you?
I am fine. How are you, Tom?
Very good. Thank you so much for carrying on with this oral history. May we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much. We left off in 1991, I believe. You had headed to Flagstaff to work for a fellow named Mike Walker. Can you tell me a little bit more about Mike and what he was doing?
Mike was a manager for Oars for many years. There was a order from the Secretary of Interior to begin an environmental impact statement. And they had a program called Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, which was headed by
Was that Dave Wagner?
Dave Wagner. I had a brain fart. I just saw him a week ago.
It's lack of coffee, John. It's all right.
I've had plenty. So Suzette and I, we got married in October, and we temporarily moved to Golden, Colorado, to where her parents live, where she went to high school. And we actually were working part-time there in Denver, not doing anything amazing, temporary work, actually, you know. And I heard about they needed boatmen, and so I just flat out did a cold call to Mike, and he answered the phone, and he said, yeah, why don't you come on out here on Christmas? It was. We launched at least ferry on December 26th. Which means we rigged on Christmas Day, and we were going to do a resupply trip for the USGS sediment survey at the cable crossing above National Canyon, and that was like a 1 month trip, as I recall. Well, no, it was. Two-week trips. Yeah, we did them back-to-back.
So two resupplies back-to-back?
Yeah. Okay. And Suzette was hired, too, as a cook. So we went down there to resupply, and Suzette went down there to, there was already a cook. They had been stationed there for not too long, but they were already there, and we were... That was going to replace the other cook.
What was USGS doing at National Canyon?
They were doing sediment studies. If you'll recall, they did these experimental flows. They were quite low. In fact, it got down to 5,000 and less. It was really interesting how they coordinated this. When we launched at Lee's Ferry, they gave us 10,000, and they told us, get below Hance, because we're going to drop it to 5. So we beelined it to Hance to avoid...
In a day?
It took us 2 days.
Okay.
And then we were also instructed to pick up some USGS employees at Phantom Ranch. So that's what we did. There were actually three expeditions launching at Lee's Ferry on the 26th. One was Scott Davis, and another one was Steve Bledsoe. And they were doing different things, but we were all launching at the same time. And it was really cold. Nobody could get their motors started except for me. I had to go to Hatch to get... starting fluid. Anyway, we finally got our motors going. Let's see. So, yeah, we just had an S-rig. It was just me and Suzette to Phantom Ranch, and then we're going to pick up, I don't know, half dozen scientists and take them down to National, but there was a big storm, and we actually did not actually get them at Phantom Ranch until like 2 days later, because the snow was they considered it unsafe, and that, you know, so we Suzette and I camped at Cremation for three nights.
Oh, so the trail was closed.
Yeah.
So the trail down to the river from the south rim was closed due to the snow.
Yeah, and we got rain.
Okay.
We didn't have snow.
Right.
But it was cold.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wearing $1,000 worth of clothing.
Wow.
Stay warm. So they finally got down there at noon, and so I deadheaded. I ran everything cold turkey till we got to below. We had finally made dinner below Bell's Chasm.
Okay, long day.
Blacktail. What is that? Stevens Conquistador Isle or Stevens Isle? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was cold, and we were supposed to have steak and potatoes, and Suzette and I made stew and handed them bowls in their tents because it was cold.
Mm.
And anyway, the next day was nice. So I just beelined it down to from, you know, 119 mile down to National in one day.
Okay. So that's a 40 miles, 35 miles, something like that. It's a long day.
Yeah. But, you know, we had, like, instead of having, like, we had 45-pounder propane bottles. We had all kinds of, you know, we had a lot of food for a lot of people.
Okay. Oh, so you were bringing in a resupply to National, including food, for the people that were there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's a switch out. You know, so one boat the next day. Well, we had to move camp. We were camped right by the cable car. It's not really a camp.
No, there's not a lot of room there at all.
No. And it was raining, and the soils were loose, and there were rock slides. You could hear them. Finally, a rock about the size of a football, no, like a rock about the size of 3 footballs, slammed into camp and missed Suzette's head by like 1 foot, hit an ammo can and crushed it.
Wow.
And Suzette said, she says, we're moving. There was no debate.
Mm.
She packed up the kitchen. We all put it on boats. And we went down to National. We went down to National Canyon proper. At the very end of the gravel bar. And made a camp there, for safety's sake.
Just because it was a bigger area, further away from the cliffs.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Which mean everybody had to walk to the cable car, but that's a, you know,
mm-hmm.
It was safer. It was. Another thing I remember is, you know, we needed firewood, and that's pretty hard to find in the Grand Canyon. But the summer before, there was a huge flash flood through Havasu, and Tuckup had just tons and tons of wood on shore. And, I mean, we had one S-rig below the riffle at National, and one parked above the riffle so that we could motor up to Tuckup. And, I mean, we would fill an S-rig an empty S rig with as much wood as we possibly could. And we burned it all. Because they worked 24 hours a day. They had shifts. And so we, as I recall, we had to cook two breakfasts, make two lunches, make two dinners every day for these shifts. You know, and then keep, and then, by the way, a national that gets no sun in the wintertime.
Okay.
So we would hike upstream just to get sun.
Wow.
Just
okay.
To warm up. It was cold. And and we're getting kind of stinky too. And so we actually took the time to construct a sweat lodge.
So and that of course, would have burned up more wood.
Heating
up rocks.
And, so it was an epic trip.
Hmm.
You know, in the mornings, the valves are frozen, the ropes are frozen. Coming down the canyon, my motor compartment was frozen. There was a half inch of an inch of ice back there. I would throw buckets of sand on it so I could get traction.
Hmm.
You know, so it was, yeah, it was a very cold trip, but it was fun. We had a blast. Anyway, so we did that back to back, and then
just going to back up a minute, the idea was the dam would go through some various flow regimes, high flow or up and down flow. Yeah, talk about the science a little bit.
So, yeah, so they had these experimental flows. I mean, you know, it was low. And, you know, I had to do, for example, Horn Creek at 5,000.
Oh, boy.
And Bedrock and Dubendorf. And, but that's okay because Cataract Canyon boatmen know rocks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't. We got through fine. We didn't have any problems. So those experimental flows were designed specifically for the sediment survey people and the vegetation surveys. And they were putting all kinds of instruments out there to, you know, for various reasons, groundwater seepage. You know, the result was, you know, what's a flow that's going to... you know, if you ramp down real fast, does that put more sediment into the river? So they would ramp it up, ramp it down, take sediment surveys to see if there was any mobilized sediment. So there were lots of jars. Of course, when they went down, the jars, these are big jars. They're like quart jars. And so going down, we're empty, but when we went to Diamond Creek to end our trip, you know, they're all full, you know. So
heavy boat.
Heavy boat. Yeah, they were very, it was a heavy boat. Going down and going back. Didn't get lighter, got heavier.
Hmm.
And so they worked at night because, you know, it takes a while for the, sediment, you know, there's two pulses through the course of the Grand Canyon traverse, you know. And so that means they had to work 24 hours, and they're out there.
So the dam would turn on during the day and then turn off at night, or they would run quite a wide variety of flow regimes. And the people way downstream at National with their empty glass jars would collect the water, and the water had suspended sediment in it from these wacky flow regimes that the dam was doing. So the thought was to correlate the variable flows coming out of the dam to look at energized sand.
Yep, mobilized, yeah.
Mobilized sand. Yeah, mobilized in the water column, and then scoop that out at National and date it and store it, and then take it out and I'm assuming blow all the water out and weigh the suspended sediment And that way you could correlate a flow at the dam with sediment transport downstream.
Yes, and there was a chief investigator, his name was John Gray. He was USGS, and there were reports. You know, they're on the internet. You can read what he exactly did. I can't remember because I was busy feeding people, getting wood, doing
Right.
They had all kinds of instruments. They had cave, you know, they would drop things, measure the speed of the river, collect samples. They had all these fish-looking like instruments, hydrodynamic, kind of like airplanes, except for fluids. And they, at night, you can imagine how bundled they were. Headlamps. Oh, batteries. Just you can imagine how many batteries we went through. And then other trips were coming through, too. You know, that's, you know, they would stop at National to chat and sometimes have lunch. So we always had visitors.
These were other trips involved with the, this is December, January. These would have been other trips as part of the environmental impact statement studies.
You know, like, so, okay, we launched on December 26th. We were trip number 191.
Okay.
That's, so.
Of the study.
Yeah. So can, that's 100 and, you know.
Yeah.
191 trips for the year 1991. And each one is like $25,000. I mean, my paychecks came, they said Bureau of Reclamation. I got checks from the Bureau of Reclamation. Hmm. You know, Suzette and I were building our house then, and we put all that money into the house. So we called, we call our house the house that Reclamation
built. Nice. How many people were there at National? 20?
Two boats. And it was me and Lars Niemi.
Okay.
I bet you between staff and USGS there were 16 people total, something like that.
Okay. That's a lot of people to be there for such a long time. And when did that whole camp break down and move out? Do you remember?
Sometime in February, we actually packed up and left.
Okay.
It was in February. It was nice then. The Lower Canyon in February is wonderful. The marigolds are coming out. You know, we actually were warm, sunny days. It was amazing how February can be so lovely.
Right. There were other trips that were coming by as the dam worked on these various flow regimes. It was 5 days or 7 days per regime, and then they would drop the river to 5,000 and hold it there for a couple of days while four survey teams, each team surveying beaches in different sections of the Grand Canyon.
Oh, yes, right.
Zipped into place and did their surveys and then boogied out to see what was happening with the sand on the beaches.
Yeah.
So all those people would have come by as well on their schedules.
Yes, because there was a team at the Little Colorado River too.
Okay.
Right. All the gauges have this going on.
And there was there a team at Phantom doing the same thing?
Well, if there was, they were probably supported by the staff at Phantom Ranch and didn't need boats.
Right. So you wouldn't know what was going on if they were doing that.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. So
a different logistic.
Just an awful lot of work going on there. Did you get a chance to talk to John Gray, USGS scientist at the time, about, you know, his thoughts on what was happening. Were you aware of what they were finding as they were finding it?
Oh yeah, John was a wonderful scientist, a good naturalist and interpreter of science. You know, there's no question that sand is being mobilized through the Grand Canyon. You know, it's in a deficit. It's kind of like watching the federal budget balloon in the other direction. So yeah, I mean, of course, all they had to really do was interview the old timers.
Right. Right.
But, you know, they needed data. They needed rates, you know. What I got out of it is it's not fixable.
Okay.
And that their day is coming when Grand Canyon river trips are going to be totally supported by cots. And, you know, that sand is being evacuated away. It'll be gone. There's no question about it, you know, and whatever... All the things they're doing are not working.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's Band-Aid. It's a gaping wound that just gets bigger.
Yeah, I mean, the Glen Canyon Dam was built. The primary purpose was sediment retention.
That's true.
So, so to try to operate a sediment-deprived system below the dam for sediment retention is kind of an oxymoron in a way. Curious.
Yeah, because it means the reservoirs fill up with sediment, then they can no longer provide water storage, and they can no longer provide flood control.
Right.
And pretty soon you have a useless dam, and you also have a safety problem. You know, I think about that. If Glen Canyon Dam fails, you know, it's going to scour 300 feet of material.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're probably going to have the biggest, nicest beaches we've ever had when it's done and over with, but it's going to severely impact the Colorado River margins because, you know, big floods can, you know, they rose 35, 40 feet historically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But a column of water that's 300 feet tall takes out a lot of stuff. It changes the... You know, it's just a bad idea. I mean, they should have never built that damn thing.
Yeah.
They're going to be sorry. The days, you know, they're going to take it down for us, Tom. They really will. They're finally going to realize how silly it is. Especially when it goes empty. And stays empty.
Well, yeah, it seems like there's two interesting risks. One is... the reservoir going empty and being unable to generate power. The other risk is that it gets knocked out by a Frankenstorm. So you know these two extremes, drought and heavy flood.
Yes, the Frankenstein. That's you know there is the other spectrum of hydrology is massive floods. You know. So next year I go down with Vic Baker and et al., and we're going to look at slackwater deposits that are probably, these are the remnants of sediment from large floods. And, you know, we have 700,000 cubic feet per second. That's our estimate.
Okay.
We'll confirm that by next year. But,
great.
Yeah.
That's a lot of water. Yeah.
Like the atmospheric river of 1862, you know, that's a dam buster.
And even that though it's not just the 300 foot high column of water, but it's what happens to the water plumbing system below there.
Yeah.
Hoover Dam and Parker and Laguna and all the way to the Sea of Cortez.
Well, it'll probably go into the Salton Sink, actually.
Ah, yes. Okay.
And then Some of the primest agriculture is going to be under 100 feet of water.
All right. So how long did you work for Mike Walker there on the environmental impact studies?
Well, I worked in the winter of 91, 92, and 93. I think I did a total of 12 trips.
Okay. And how did you and Suzette decide to build a house in Moab?
Well, remember, Moab used to be a nice place to be poor.
Mm.
And in 1984, the Reagan administration canceled the Truman Executive Order of stockpiling rare and precious metals. And for the Moab area, that meant uranium and vanadium. So we had this big, huge mining boom, and then the subsidy went away, and the companies bankrupted, and people moved away. I mean, you could buy a three-bedroom, two-bathroom house in Moab for less than $30,000.
Wow.
Some were even selling at less than that.
Hmm.
So river guides all of a sudden could afford homes.
Okay.
But we brought, so Suzette and I bought property. We were going to build our own house. And we bought a half-acre lot for $8,000. And I could, if I were to do that today, I'd be spending $150,000 to $200,000.
Yeah.
So we were very lucky, you know, and we built our house. We built a basement for $11,000, and then we spent another $45,000 to finish it.
Okay.
So it took us 3 years. But, so I was, you know, I had a trip log. I was on the river, in those 3 years, I was on the river for an average of 280 days a year.
Okay.
Not spending any money, because I'm on the river. And so I was, both me and Suzette, all our paychecks were going in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's how we paid for our house. We just socked it away.
And but only 12 trips in Grand Canyon. Where else were you boating? Was this back in Cataract Canyon again in the summer?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was working 7 months a year in Moab and probably 3 months a year in Grand Canyon. No, 2 months a year in Grand Canyon.
Okay.
No, I probably only had 90 off days that whole time.
Mm-hmm. And just saving up your money. And did you contract out for the house, or did you guys build it yourself?
No, yeah, we contracted the concrete.
Okay, contracted the basement, sure.
The rest we did. We did it, okay. Yeah, we did everything.
So in between river trips, you'd pound nails and put down roofing and hang windows and go from there.
Stretch wire. And
yeah. Okay.
And put in some plumbing and drains and vents and roof and drywall.
Had you been thinking at this time about river conservation and looking into that or was that going to come a little later?
No, it was actually kind of happening. There were a series of events in the 90s that first of all I got sober.
Okay.
Second of all, I decided to be more socially engaged to control my anger and resentment
okay.
for the way things run in the world. And so one of my friends asked me if I wanted to be on the board of the Dan O'Loughlin Museum because they knew I was an amateur historian and a writer. And I was actually president of the museum here in Moab for 3 years, and I did the Canyon Legacy. I did like four or five issues of the Canyon Legacy.
How do you spell O'Loughlin?
O'Loughlin.
And who was Dan O'Loughlin?
He was part of the uranium businessman.
Okay.
Prominent leader in Moab. It's now called the Moab Museum.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was fun because I had to make the magazine, I had to call writers and get out PageMaker, Adobe PageMaker, and craft these 36-page journals, edit, research. You know, it was fun. What it did was it prepared me for the founding of Colorado Plateau River Guides.
Okay. And so this was being a board on the museum, that was 92 or 3?
Yeah. Yeah, there were Park Service people on the board, archaeologists, businessmen, ranchers. It was a diverse group. It was fun. I got to know a lot of the old timers.
Nice.
Yeah.
And when did you meet Owen?
That happened in, 1996.
Okay, so it's a little, so we're not quite there yet.
No, but that, Brower introduced the two of us, quite frankly.
And how did you meet David Brower?
Well, so Richard Ingebretson, started a group called the Glen Canyon Institute, and he was searching for board members. And at the time, I was in Salt Lake City doing research at the Marriott Library.
Okay.
Specifically about the riverbed case, as I recall, but I was also, in those days, I had to photocopy everything. You know, so I spent the whole day. I'd get on the bus. I'd stay with my friend, Bob Stevens, my case manager, get on the bus, go to the Marriott, stay there all day, take the bus back to Bob's, and photocopying, because nothing was online in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought microfiche from the Utah Historical Society archives. There was, maybe it was the SHPO office, I can't remember. About the riverbed case, and it was all on microfiche, and I had to, like 10,000 pages of documents, and I pressed the button 10,000 times.
Okay.
kind
of like we do today with our digital cameras.
yeah, I did that yesterday, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah, I take a lot of photos of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And this was 94... I mean, what interested you about the riverbed case? Why were you looking into that?
Because it's the largest oral history on the Colorado River.
Indeed it is.
You know, it was a Supreme Court case, USA versus Utah. It was about who owns the riverbed. And so they interviewed everybody who was alive. I mean, Frederick Dellenbaugh. Cold Brothers, I mean, Bert Loper, E.C. LaRue, I mean, they interviewed everybody. It's like, it's a gold mine.
Harry McDonald, I mean, Edwards, it just went on and on. Yeah,
Yeah, and then, but I would also go to, like, the Utah Historical Society, and I would, that's where the Haleson archive is.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles Kelly and all those. So yeah, I was learning a lot about the Colorado River, especially the Upper Basin, because compared to the Grand Canyon, the Upper Basin is relatively a historical void. Because I always feel like Grand Canyon authors just keep doing the same thing. There's really nothing new happening. You know, that's why I'm proud of you doing the Marston thing. Why wasn't that done 50 years ago?
Yeah, I'm curious. So what did researching these oral histories from the 20s, I believe, that riverbed case was. Is that right?
Yeah.
And they're talking about the river and their experiences on it. What did that teach you that you didn't already know?
I didn't. It was all new information.
Okay.
I started getting off my boat. I was actually walking. A lot of times I'd let Suzette row, and I would just walk the roads along the river, especially in like Labyrinth and Labyrinth Canyon. And so I'm finding all the inscriptions from all these. Lots of people went down the Green Rivers, even during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a lot of people who went down there who don't have any, we don't know anything about.
Right.
And then, you know, once James Nipmeyer and I spent a week scouring river bottoms looking for inscriptions, and we were never disappointed. And we found old steamboat camps. We know where they like to stop and get driftwood to put in the boilers. That's usually where we found the inscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, a few years ago, I was surmised that perhaps this would have an inscription, and it did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of times when you go down the river, you're just there to enjoy the river, but I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have found a lot of stuff. And I keep a lot of it to myself, but when I have something archaeologically important, I usually notify the Park Service.
Uh-huh. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes burials are not fun to find, but they're out there.
Mm-hmm. So going through the riverbed case sort of helped you understand the river before reclamation, before the upstream dams and the downstream dams, by learning what the people who were on the water, the steamboat people, Wimmer, Yoki, I mean, just a whole bunch of people that were there doing that kind of stuff. Did that help you start to understand a little bit more about the river without a lot of water diversion?
Yes. You know, the sandbar situation below Green River and Moab is, you know, part of the navigation of the criteria for the case. You know, this is no different than Arizona versus California. They had a special master. They met in various parts of the country, Denver, Salt Lake City, San Francisco, Santa Fe. It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they would enter, you know, and so it includes the San Juan River, too. And it involves USGS people, steamboat captains, gold miners, oil prospectors, you know, you name it, they're fascinating history.
Yeah.
Placer miners.
So Richard invited you to go ahead and join Glen Canyon Institute, is that right?
Yeah, Eleanor Inskip, who lives here in Moab, and I and Richard met at the Spaghetti Company. And anyway, yeah, we said yes. I think we were the first board members. There might have been somebody before us, but, you know, eventually Brower would show up, like maybe 2 years later.
Okay.
And that was what changed a lot of, Brower changed my entire focus and direction. And I'm glad about that. And I took he offered me an invitation, and I accepted it.
Okay. Before we get to Dave, you mentioned the Colorado Plateau River Guides. Did you start that organization before you met Brower?
Yes.
And about what time was that? When did you start that?
Well, so that came from Tim Thomas, who was a river guide for Colorado Outward Bound, and Sherry Griffith, and he lives in Durango now. And he said, you know, we ought to start a River Guides Association, and I agreed. And at the time, the president of Grand Canyon River Guides was, by the way, I was one of the first members when Kent Grua started Grand Canyon River Guides. It was in Mike Walker's warehouse. I actually was there the day they had their first, it might have been the second meeting, and, you know, that's when I wrote my first check. but by 1993, the president is Brad Demick.
Okay.
So I called Brad, and I said, hey, we'd like to start an organization up here in the Upper Basin. And so the two of us then worked with Jane and Ken Slight, and we had a meeting. And there were like 50 people there.
Okay.
Park service people, state park people, outfitters, river guides, river activists. It was a very interesting meeting. And anyway, we got about $1,000 of donations right then and there.
Hmm.
And Suzette was elected president. I was elected secretary. And Suzette and I started immediately writing the Journal of the Colorado Plateau River Guides, which is called The Confluence. And I think we got it out in February. And so, you know, we were in and out with a product within 2 or 3 months.
Mm.
We're pretty serious about it.
And of course, the work that you'd done for the museum, you know, as you said, working with Adobe PageMaker set you up to very easily start doing the journal for the Colorado Plateau River Guides?
Yeah, something like that. I think, actually, you know, now that I think about it, I think I'm getting my dates wrong. We can correct this later on, but I think it was the other way around. My work for Colorado Plateau River Guides is how would create Canyon Legacies later on.
Okay.
We can fix that.
Okay.
Because in those days, it was pretty much cut and paste. And the printer would take a picture. And that's how it was done back then. It wasn't done with computers.
Okay, so two organizations, suddenly one is Glen Canyon Institute.
Yeah, and like 94, 95.
Okay, and then, all right, so Colorado Plateau River Guides was a couple years before then.
93, 94.
Okay. All right.
And my museum stint was like 91 to 93. I'm also on the board of Canyonlands Field Institute.
Okay. At the same time?
Yeah. So I started out as public education.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of environmental education. You know, but then that meeting with Colorado Plateau River Guides kind of changed me because there were, river guides were different then. They did want to take dams down. They did want wilderness. Of course, the outfitters didn't. they wanted wild and scenic. You know, and they also, some of them wanted to unionize. Oh man, did that create fear with the outfitters. So could say I kind of bit off more than I could chew.
How so?
But I did it anyway.
How so?
I don't know. I just immersed myself into the controversy, started forming opinions for myself. Didn't care if people thought I was radical or out of line. I just don't care about stuff like that. I don't like being accommodated. I want a very changed river because it's been changed. We need restoration, and I decided I'm just going to make this my passion. Because nobody else is really serious about doing it.
Okay.
They talk about it.
That's right.
There's a lot of talk. Kind of reminds me of that joke, how do you know a river guide is lying? No, wait, how does that go? I forget how.
You were pretty close.
I've heard a lot of lectures from river guides.
Hmm.
Very rarely are they informative. It's mostly about jokes.
Well, in their defense, their job is to cater to clientele, some of which aren't interested in the flora and the fauna and the ecology and the river history. They're interested in jokes. They want to be entertained.
I understand that, but I do not agree with it.
Well, I agree, but I'm just, there's a perspective that says we're entertainers we need to hire entertainers because our clients need to be entertained.
No, I went out of my way to make natural history fun.
Nice.
I really did. Even if I didn't feel confident about my lecture, I'd do it anyway because I said to myself, the only way you're going to get better is if you just do it, mistakes or not. I had these moments of, well, that was really bad. How could I change that?
Mm-hmm.
And then, with 2 or 3 years of doing that, you can come up with a bomber.
Yeah, interp.
Interp that everybody's interested in.
Right.
So I think, and here's what's interesting is after a while, the jokes aren't important anymore. I started getting more attention. I was which made the other river guides somewhat envious.
Hmm.
And then I had to deal with that.
Okay.
But, oh well.
So, when did you first meet Dave Brower? Did Richard Ingebrigtsen, did he go out and contact Dave just based on Brower's prior work in river conservation and dam issues? I was kind of wondering how that connection all happened.
Well,
or did Elinor Inskip do that?
Elinor was the first executive director of Canyonlands Natural History Association, so and I was just a river guide. And, the two of us aren't dynamic environmental leaders, at least we're not back then. We're newbies. We know what we want. We don't know how to do it.
Okay.
Well, Brower knows how to do it.
Okay.
And,
so Brower knew how to do environmental campaigns.
Yes, he did. And he got wind. I think Brower actually reached out to Glen Canyon Institute. You're going to have to interview Richard to find out for sure.
Okay.
What I remember is that Brower and Martin Litton ended up coming to the Glen Canyon Institute meeting at the University of Utah, and that's the meeting that changed my life.
When was that?
I'm going to say it was 1996. And actually, what I did was, is I walked up to Brower. I was mad at him, actually. I have since learned that I was completely wrong, but that's okay. Because I wouldn't have asked the question that changed my life forever. So, you know, I told him how disappointed I was that he lost the fight for Glen Canyon Dam. And instead of defending himself, he said to me, "That's right, John. Now what are you going to do about it?"
Hmm.
He turned it around, and he put it right back in my lap where it really, truly belonged.
Nice.
And I went, and I said to myself, he's right. I don't have the right to do this. I'm glad I asked the question, though.
Uh-huh.
Because I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have had this reflection. And I went, he's right. He said, you can change, you can do a better job than I ever could, John, because you're a river guide. You have standing.
Hmm.
When you go to a meeting, they're going to know that you're speaking from the heart and that you're authentic. He says, I think the river guides can do a better job than I ever could. And I took that to heart. I agreed with him. And I said, well, what do I do? And he said, we had these long conversations on the phone, Tom. I never took notes. I should have. But it probably wasn't necessary because I remember everything. And, you know, and I went, you know, I just kind of like went, yeah, I'm going to do this. You know, he was, at the time, he was getting old and feeble, and he was in wheelchairs, and I was carting him around and taking him to airports. And then, so I got a lot of one-on-one time with him,
mm-hmm.
a lot of it, and more than I needed, but enough to go, yep, this is how you get the campaign going. That's how I met Owen. So we're, because of David's influence, we're being introduced to like the John Muir Sierrans, which is the left liberal fringe of the Sierra Club. A lot of these people are board members on the Sierra Club. There was a big, huge fight in the Sierra Club about this, you might recall.
Yeah.
There were hearings, and Jim Hansen is chair of the Natural Resources Committee and is having debates and congressional level committees to discuss the removal of Glen Canyon Dam. It was pretty hot and heavy back then. But we were having meetings at International Rivers Network at Brower's insistence in Berkeley. And that's how I met Owen, because Owen was the executive director of the International Rivers Network. Owen told me that every Sunday, Brower would make waffles and bacon for breakfast, and anybody and everybody was welcome to come. And Owen would go to those waffle and bacon breakfasts for years.
Isn't that interesting? Because Marston did the same thing, waffles for breakfast on Sunday.
Who did that?
Marston.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's a Berkeley thing.
I you gotta wonder.
So anyway, so that's when I met Ann Brower and some of the children. Of course, they are full-grown adults.
Mm-hmm.
And, so yeah, changed me forever.
How so?
Well, it was like my recovery from alcoholism. I had a way to constructive way to deal with my anger.
Okay.
And now I had some guidance. You know, a mentor. Like, if he can do it, so can I.
Okay.
He gave me the greatest. He just was just showered out great advice. Don't be afraid of your mistakes. In fact, you'll be surprised how your mistakes actually will be beneficial down the road.
Hmm.
Stuff like that. You know,
nice.
Be fearless. Don't be afraid to make one, a mistake. You know, the caution is not how you drive a campaign. You know, it's how you run a business, not a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably why NGOs fail, is they're not running campaigns, they're running a business.
Right. Nice. So, what else do you remember about David?
Well, you know, there was one profound thing he told me. It was almost a prophecy. He was upset. This is like 1997. And he was upset with all the river. I think he said something like there's 300 river groups in this country and none of them work together.
Mm.
You know, we're just spinning wheels, you know. And he says, so our, you know, he made it very clear that the responsibility is ours, not presidents, Congress, courts. He put all the heavy weight on the conservation movement. And then he told me, but he said, someday it's going to change. And he says, I don't know what it is, but there's something going to happen in the future where all the river groups. He was specific about river groups, not the forest groups, not the ocean groups.
Mm-hmm.
That the river community would. He said, and I, you know, and I still don't know what it is, but every day I think about this. What's it going to be? What it's going to emerge? I don't know what it is. David didn't know what it is, but it's going to emerge. And when it does, you know, I'm kind of like the guy in the lighthouse looking for the emergence of this prophecy.
Hmm.
And I have my theories about what it might be, and I think my best theory is when these reservoirs go empty.
Okay.
People are going to go, oh, shit. Now what do we do?
Right.
Or, contrarily, this big atmospheric river comes and takes all the dams away.
Right. So without a giant flood and without a drought, our demand for water has exceeded the supply. And that's a third factor, is not just drought, no water to fill the reservoir, and not just a giant flood to knock it out, but even with normal snowpack, whatever normal is, if our demand for the water in the system passes that supply, we have a whole nother problem to look at.
Yeah, which makes me realize who my new mentor is. I mean, I'm 65. It's kind of like, why does a 65-year-old person need a mentor? I've been working with Vic Baker since 2005.
Mm-hmm.
On this paleo flood hydrology. And, you know, I've done river trips with this guy. And I have a lot of downtime with this guy. And I find out he used to be the president of the Geological Society of America, which is not an easy position to get. And I'm finding out how incredibly intelligent Vic is.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's a true PhD. He's very philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks into the future and he analyzes the hearts and minds of anything and everything. And so he's become my second mentor.
Great.
You know, and he says these astounding things that self-correct me. They're such good truisms. You know, you just can't help but latch onto them and glue them onto your, or stick them on your lapel. You know?
Like what?
Well, I asked him about climate change, and he goes, he gave the best answer I've ever heard in my life. He goes, John, we've never adapted to climate change. What makes you think we're going to do it in the future? You know, and he's right. You know, that's what Donald Worster's book is about, is the failure of adapting to climate, hydrologically speaking, since the dawn of civilization.
Right. You know,
we just don't adapt to climate. And if we did, then we wouldn't have empty reservoirs. If we did, we wouldn't have to worry about dams failing. If we did, we wouldn't have to worry about reservoirs filling up with sediment. We're trained not to adapt to climate. So it's something we should have done centuries ago. You know, if we had, we wouldn't be in the mess we're at today. What complicates it is now there. This is another great thing Vic told me was, in the meantime, what we've done is put a lot of big things in all the wrong places.
As in cities and deserts and things?
Yep. Dams, skyscrapers and earthquake faults, houses and forests. You know, we have a planning and zoning problem more than a climate. We could adapt to climate change, but it's our planning and zoning that prevents us from doing it, you know. And like when I told you I could build a house for $55,000, you know, if I were to look, I'm in a floodplain. I wish I had thought about this. I'm in a 500-year floodplain. So, you know, okay, so if I got serious about it, you know, like, oh, my God, I'm going to sell my house and then put the risk on somebody else.
Right.
I can't move this house. I could walk away from it at a huge loss. And to build a home in Moab now is you need $300,000.
Right.
So everything is going to be more expensive. You know, Vic told me, I said, what's our future? And he says, oh, that's easy. Relocating, removing, remodeling.
Yeah.
The R's. Pick and choose your R. You know, that's our future. You know, we're not, you know, he said, we're not going to Mars. We're not leaving the solar system. You know, we're going to be spending money like you've never, like.
Yeah, it's, you know, certainly looking at climate change and the, as Vic's talking about, building in the wrong places, our cities on coasts, now, Los Angeles, New York City, and not to mention earthquake faults and dams on rivers, etc. So it's there's been a lot of infrastructural development that is now going to be relocated, removed, and remodeled. Yeah, that's very good. The three R's.
Yeah. So. Anyway, I can't help but feel it's all imminent. Maybe I'll miss it because I only probably got 20 years left. But my young employees are going to have to deal with it.
Yeah.
So I think about them. Like, you know, in a way, Brower put me in charge of my own life. And I do that too. I tell young people, first of all, I apologize for what baby boomers didn't
Yeah.
And I'm not going to stand in your way.
Right.
I'll help you. And that resonates with them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's authentic.
Right.
They already know that.
Right.
So it's nice when a baby boomer admits.
Yeah, that there's a lot of work yet to do, and certainly can resonate with that. Okay, so you met Brower, you met Owen Lammers. How do you spell Owen's last name?
Lammers.
Thank you. And you two started Living Rivers, is that right?
Yeah, well, and Brower. The three of us met or talked on the phone, I can't remember, and you know, we decided it was a good idea to start a new organization in Moab.
Okay.
You know, because it's right next to the Colorado River.
Okay.
You know, a river community.
And when did you do that?
It was in 1999. Here.
Okay, in Moab in 1999.
Yeah, we were.
All right.
He left International Rivers Network. They gave him a severance check of $20,000, I think.
Okay.
And we rented an ice cream store. And we had a waffle and bacon party on January 1st, 2000, you know, the day after Y2K. That was our first meeting. Ken Slight was there. And that, we consider that the beginning of our organization.
Okay, I tell you what, we've been yik-yakking a little over an hour, and maybe January 21st, 2000 is a good time to start part five.
Okay, I think you're right.
All right, very good. Well, with that, this will conclude part four, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with John Weisite. Today is Monday, November 25th, 2019. My name is Tom Martin. And John, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.